A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display? I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 251. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are continuing our discussion about A Ghost Story for Christmas. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon in England. Hello. Yes, with a certain sadness, it's our last of the M.R. James stories from the original 1970s BBC series that ran once a year from 71 to 78, A Ghost Story for Christmas. Last episode, if you were listening, we covered a creepy tale of a hidden treasure with a terrible guardian, the treasure of Abbot Thomas. But we're moving on to another show. In fact, as we say, the last of the M.R. James from the original series, Brian.
Yes, that's right. We are this time talking about The Ash Tree, which was, as you say, the last of the M.R. James stories that they used in the original 1970s run of A Ghost Story for Christmas. They went on after this point to use one Charles Dickens story and a couple of originals.
But here we are in classic Jamesian territory, as I say, for perhaps the last time for a while.
Yes, and again we are looking at a story from the M.R. James collection, Ghost Stories of an Antiquary, from 1904. Sir Richard Fell, played by Edward Petherbridge, who would be in another M.R. James story, ITV's Casting the Runes, in 1979, which we've also covered.
Yes, interesting actor, Edward Petherbridge. Just as an aside, he's perhaps the definitive, certainly in terms of television, the definitive Lord Peter Wimsey, in my humble estimation. Although listeners who are of my age will perhaps have fond memories of Ian Carmichael playing him in the films. But yes, so interesting actor, and he is here, Sir Richard Fell, as you say, who's just inherited his family's home, Castringham Hall, which is in Suffolk. And there's a strange history to the hall. We know that Sir Richard's ancestor, Sir Matthew, who's also played in the flashback sequences by Edward Petherbridge himself, that Sir Matthew was responsible for the persecution and subsequent execution of a local witch, a woman called Mrs. Mothersoul, played by the actress Barbara Ewing. And we get to see some of the grisly details in these flashback sequences.
Yes, that's right. Sir Richard has this plan to turn the hall into a new family home with his wife, Augusta, who is played by Lalla Ward, who famously went on to be the second version of Romana in Doctor Who. And they have extensive plans for not only the hall, but also for a new pew and a new extension to the local church.
Yes, that's right. There's going to be some extension and building work at the church as well as at the hall. And that will lead, particularly in the case of the church, for something to be disturbed.
Yes, in order to do this, they have to move one grave, which is in an odd position very close to the church where they want to extend things. So they have this one grave to move. And of course, it's the grave of this local witch, Mrs. Mothersoul.
Yes, I mean, it's slightly odd that it's right next to the church, but they do make a point of saying that it's in unhallowed ground. So it's not in the hallowed ground of the church's graveyard. It's slightly outside that because of her history and reputation. But it does seem odd that they buried her so close to the church. But there you go. If you start making extensions and digging things up, well, in classic M.R. James style, you will perhaps find something that you might regret.
Yes, of course. And the witch's grave is indeed disturbed for this purpose. And that sets off this sort of haunting, which centers on this large ash tree, which stands right outside Richard's bedroom, right outside the window to the hall there.
Yes, in Carstenham Hall, he's got this ash tree, and he assumes that the ash tree blowing in the wind is responsible for the strange scratching noises he hears at the window of his bedroom. And he does get a few clues and hints from various people who tell him it's unlucky to have an ash tree so near to the house. You know, nowadays we'd be thinking of structural damage, but back then they felt it was an unlucky thing, and he's warned about this. And it's going to, as we say, we've got the disturbed witch's grave. Of course, when they disturb the grave, they find out there doesn't appear to be a body in the coffin, which is an element of mystery. And it's all going to lead to some memorable sound effects, some extremely creepy spider beasties, and a terrible conclusion. This one sort of moves along at a fair pace, and we're quite soon in towards the really nasty haunting towards the end of the show.
Yes, absolutely. This time the adaptation was by David Rudkin, who had earlier written a well-known play for today called Penda's Fan, which actually starred Spencer Banks from Timeslip.
Yes, an interesting show, one that's recently been put out by the BFI, Penda's Fen. And it is rather strange, as we mentioned the last episode, that John Bowen had written a play for today called Robin Redbreast, which fits into that early 70s folk horror genre that we have touched upon in the past. So, yeah, Penda's Fen and Robin Redbreast, who knows? That might make an interesting pairing to talk about at some point in the future, or we may do them by themselves. We'll see.
Yes, and Rudkin, who adapted this one, would go on to write Artemis 81, which we've covered. And both of these writers we're looking at who did these adaptations did these 1970s M.R. James ghost story adaptations and had done these sort of folk horror type things earlier on. And both of them went on to do rather complex and somewhat obscure shows that are interesting, but a challenge to follow at times, with Artemis 81 and The Ice House. So it's interesting to see these different things in common with these writers. And I think these various shows that they worked on were all quite good, but had some quite different things in them, which is interesting.
Yes, I mean, I'm a one for seeing patterns in things, particularly when we're talking about British invaders. And I am interested by the two television screenwriters having this slightly similar path from Play for Today through a Christmas, a ghost story for Christmas, and then on to something that's a little bit unusual. The Ice House is slightly strange and disturbing, as we talked about last time. But Artemis 81, well, one of the great unfathomable mysteries that we've discussed in British Invaders history, Brian.
Yes, that one was a really neat show, but it is really quite complex and has all these layers in it.
Yeah. But back to The Ash Tree and A Ghost Story for Christmas.
It was, as always, directed by Lawrence Gordon Clark, who directed this whole run of ghost stories through the 1970s. And they were looking for locations, that's always very crucial to these stories. And they found a suitable hall in Suffolk that had the big sort of manor house kind of feel to it, which they needed. But they couldn't find a manor house that also had an ash tree going next to it. But the farmhouse where Clark himself was living at the time, near Pasto in Cornwall, did have this enormous ash tree that was in fact right next to the house. So they in fact used both. They used a manor house, and then for the shots where you needed the ash tree, they used the farmhouse and did these shots to make it seem like you were looking at the same place.
Yes, it's neatly done because the shots of Edward Petherbridge standing outside his Castrenham Hall home as Sir Richard fell, looking up at the ash tree that he and one of the other characters are talking about. And of course, there's nothing there for them to look at. Although I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect that there are some stagehands or some, I don't know what they would call them, some gophers off screen who are holding some branches up, because you do see some leaves and branches in shot. But that must be somebody off camera who's just sort of waving some useful props around, I guess, Brian.
Yes, I'm not sure of the details of how they put those together. But yeah, they did make it work so that it seemed like you had the one place that was set up that way.
And as well as looking for obscure patterns in the shows we cover, I also love a story from the production of a show. And this time, with regards to the tree, we get two great stories told by Lawrence Gordon Clark in his introduction to the show, which, as ever, we recommend you watch at the end rather than at the beginning because of the spoilers. And the first story regards to the dressing of the actual ash tree at his farmhouse in Cornwall for the final scenes. And I don't want to give away too many spoilers for the show, but obviously they had to put some special effects on this tree. And apparently it terrified Clark's 6-year-old son, which if you've seen this show, you would probably imagine it would terrify a 6-year-old, because it's pretty spooky for an adult as well.
Yes, they put all of these things onto the tree, these sort of horrific spider-type creatures. And it seemed like they got a lot of them in there, but after the production, they didn't end up getting quite all of them out again. So a few of them were left there, and this was where Lawrence Gordon Clark and his family were living.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, the other great story is that this was 1975. Now, if you were around in the 70s, you'll know that 1976, the longest, hottest summer possibly that we can remember, and of course, a famous drought when everybody was running out of water. And as a result, the ash tree at this Padstow farmhouse died. But of course, according to Lawrence Gordon Clark, the rumour went around that it wasn't killed by the drought. The rumour went around that it was actually killed by the witch, Mrs. Mothersole, and that in filming and dressing the tree, they had somehow invoked a local curse. And I do find this absolutely, glorious and a certain spooky thing, because M.R. James created this character of Mrs. Mothersole, the witch, and yet she's one of those fictional characters that almost feels like she's actually real. We know that there are other, true historical characters that James perhaps based her on, but it feels now like she's almost become bigger than the fiction, and she's branched out into a urban legend that there might actually have been a terrible witch called Mrs. Mothersole. Something that spooks me from time to time. Anyway, I love these stories from Lawrence Gordon Clark on the DVD box set. They do add to the viewing, I think.
There are some wonderful, strange things in there, aren't there?
Absolutely, yes. And we should mention, as last time we talked about some of the changes in the adaptation of The Treasure of Abbot Thomas because of certain aspects of James's original story that didn't perhaps transfer well to television. Again, this production does perhaps slightly change the relationship between the witch and Sir Richard's ancestor, Sir Matthew Fell. And this suggestion that he's persecuting her, not because he thinks she actually is a witch, but because perhaps there was some sexual attraction, that maybe she rejected his advances. There is something of that. And in order to convey this in the production, they do use some female nudity of the attractive young actress playing the witch. And that some of those sequences do haunt the dreams of both Sir Matthew and Sir Richard. So we should warn you, there is some female nudity in this one.
Yes, that's true. And I think that is different from the other ghost stories from this run that they did that.
Yeah, slightly more adult themes creeping in perhaps as the 70s moved along.
Now, of course, they had these strange spider creatures, which the director, Lawrence Gordon Clark, considers a failure because of, how they looked. but they're actually remembered quite fondly, I guess you could say, as being something quite horrific by the people who saw them at the time. I think probably in part because they shot them in a way where you didn't see that much. You had sort of glimpses that increased through the course of the thing, and it was very shadowy. So I think the way they were used was interesting.
Yes, it's an interesting effect. As you say, Brian, as ever, something that's heard and only glimpsed is much more scary to us. And then when the beasties appear, it's a bit like that sort of paradox we've talked about when we discussed Doctor Who monsters in the past, that the borderline between ridiculous and terrifying is quite fine. So some people remember them as looking a bit silly, whereas I think far more people who saw it at the time regard them as quite terrifying. When they start to burn at the end, if I may quote Jim Moon from the excellent Hypnagoria podcast, there's quite a few people who are saying, yes, burn, you terrible little monsters.
Yeah, there were interesting things in the way they were used, I think, as compared to the actual props.
Yeah.
The Ash Tree was broadcast on December 23rd, 1975. It ran 32 minutes and was in color.
Yes, a shorter one, and it does zip along and get to this nasty conclusion quite quickly. Splendid. So we've covered the two shows. It's time for our own sort of views and reviews. So we'll start by sort of jumping back to The Treasure of Abbot Thomas. What would you like to say about that one on the positive side first, Brian?
Okay, it was an interesting one. They did modify this one from the original story a little more than they usually do. But I think they did that quite well. I really liked their use of the location and making parts of it come across as quite spooky. It's a good location, and as always, it's very well directed.
Yes, Lawrence Gordon Clark does a splendid job with these shows, and he goes to some wonderful places. I mean, I thought Norwich Cathedral last year in the stalls of Barchester looked particularly good, but this time in Wells Cathedral, and some of the terrifying sequences on the roof and the creepy gargoyles, and then, of course, this weird underground water passageway or culvert. Great stuff in terms of locations, great direction. Michael Bryant's performance as the skeptical scholar Summerton, what did you think of him, Brian?
I thought it was good. It wasn't one of the most remarkable performances we've seen in the run, but I thought it was solid.
Yes, I actually liked him in this more than I did in The Stone Tape, where I thought he was a little bit, the character he was playing was rather sort of hyperbolic and excitable, whereas here he's a much more reserved Oxford academic and cleric, so it's a reined-in performance. But I thought the transition from skeptic to terrified victim of a supernatural encounter was quite well done. And interestingly, again, going back to the introductions, Lawrence Gordon Clark, I think, reckons that he calls Michael Bryant's performance right up there in the top two from the whole series, alongside Denham Elliott's rather marvellous The Signalman, which you may remember when we talked about that show, some of the production incidents that led to perhaps Elliott doing this really sort of haunted performance.
Yes, interesting. There were definitely strong performances in most of the shows in this series. I liked the seance sequence they gave him at the beginning, and it was new for the television production, but it set up the characters well, these two main characters, and it gave you the idea that he was willing and able to use his sort of academic and historical knowledge to debunk things or to figure things out and sort of do a strange sort of detective work.
Yes, an interesting way of doing it, and it works very well. And I like the pairing of the scholar and his student as the detective partnership, who get to explain things to each other and thus to us, the viewer. So yeah, I did like that. I thought it was very well done. And of course, we have to mention the music is wonderful. I really enjoyed that. And I should imagine that you would be particularly interested in the music for that one, Brian.
Yes, actually, the music was quite strong in that. They did some choral or small vocal ensemble work that had quite a bit of countertenor in there, which very often can give a spooky kind of feel. And they mixed it with sort of other recorded sounds and I think electronic things. It is quite effective for what it does.
Okay. Also quite effective, I think, is the depiction of the slime creature and of the ghost itself. But also, you know, as we've mentioned, they are kept to very brief glimpses, which works particularly well for any form of ghost story. So I thought those were good.
Yes, this goes back to the idea that what can be most effective is often what you don't see. And I think Lawrence Gordon Clark always embraced that by showing us glimpses of things, and we rarely, if ever, see something sort of in its full detail. We see shadowy glimpses and brief glimpses and, you know, lots of moody lighting and things that work very well for these types of stories.
Okay, so there's lots of splendid stuff to recommend The Treasure of Abbot Thomas for. Were there any elements that didn't work for you quite so well? I mean, as you've mentioned, Michael Bryant's performance perhaps not standing out to you, but was there anything else, Brian?
I think overall it was solid. There is the idea that this had to vary and move away from the original story quite a bit, which often these productions avoided doing that, and it's certainly understandable why they did, but we have to note that they weren't able to make it as close to the original story as many of them did.
Yes, if you are, I suppose, a Jamesian purist, you may have a few problems with the television adaptation. Personally, I think they did a very fine job, and I found it spooky and unsettling to watch it again. Or in fact, this was my first viewing of it, in fact. So yes, I found it quite enjoyable.
Yes, there's some very nice stuff there. I should note as well, and this was something that Lawrence Gordon Clark talked about in his introduction, this church where they made very good use of it, as we said, there was a gargoyle there that they used as the gargoyle looking down on this this culvert. They're often, you know, the gargoyles give you these, you know, horrific kinds of strange creatures, and they had those. But this particular one is this sort of pained-looking hooded figure, you know, that looks like the possibly the face of a woman looking pained and sort of wrapped in something so you can't see it very well. Very unusual and more human looking gargoyle, and that they made great use of it.
Yes, they do splendid things with the location work on this particular show. Okay, let's turn to the following year and The Ash Tree, which we've just been talking about. I think another fine adaptation, perhaps slightly closer to the actual Jamesian story this time. Edward Petherbridge does a great job as the two versions of the Fell family, suitably troubled in both cases, particularly as the show progresses. So I think he's very good.
Yes, I would agree. He was, I think, did a very strong performance with the two different versions. It was nice seeing how they were sort of set apart, and you would have the current Lord of the Manor sort of drifting into almost picking up the events and the personality of his predecessor. So that was sort of quite creepy and well done, both in how it was shot and in the performance.
Okay. Now, I know there was another performance that you particularly were interested in this show, particularly when it came to horseback riding.
Well, we have Lala Ward in this, which, of course, as a Doctor Who fan, it's lovely to see her in something a few years before she was a popular companion on Doctor Who. They introduce her in a scene where she is indeed riding up to the manor house. And I think differently from how things are done in most modern productions, it was done in a wide shot where you could very clearly see that it was Lala Ward and that she was doing her own riding in full, very elaborate costume. So it was nice to see them using that, and not only to show that she was clearly able to ride and in a big elaborate dress costume, but I think it also is quite effective as an introduction. It's a style of shooting that we don't see as much, so it was nice to see it there.
Yeah, it was great, actually. It's a fine introduction to her character, and she rides a horse very well, so it does work very well. What about the location? I mean, we don't have anything as architecturally creepy as Wells Cathedral here, but I guess they make good use of the manor house, and they, as we've said already, they managed to combine the two locations for the tree and the house seamlessly, so we don't really notice the join at all.
Yes, I think that combination worked very well, and the ash tree itself is enormous, and it's right up on top of that house. So it's exactly what you want for this, and I thought that worked very well. The shots they did inside the church and the shots where he was drifting back to Sir Matthew's life and talking about Mrs. Mothersoul as a living person rather than as, you know, this long-dead person who was buried, those made very good use of that space, I think, and it was very effective shooting in general.
Okay. Yes, it's a pity that the ash tree itself is no longer there, because I do holiday in Padstow in Cornwall sometimes, and I'd almost be tempted to try and track down this farmhouse that Lawrence Gordon Clark was living in at the time. But of course, as we've said, it didn't survive the 76 drought or the witch's curse.
Yes, indeed. I think in general, this show is very well done, and it shows again Lawrence Gordon Clark's very fine direction, especially when it comes to doing these spooky sorts of things and all of the moody lighting and things. Very nicely done.
Okay. Now, of course, if I'm correct, in the original M.R. James story, Mrs. Mothersoul is quite clearly a witch. And I don't think there's any doubt in the supernatural nature of what happens to Sir Richard at the end of this story in the television production. But it was interesting that they tried to do something about perhaps the persecution of lower class women that the actual infamous witch trials probably represented in its depiction of Sir Matthew's persecution of this woman. But then, of course, you know, it slightly has its cake and eats it by then saying, oh, yeah, well, quite clearly she is a witch, because if you watch the end of the show, there's not much doubt, is there, Brian?
Yes, that's right. But they do sort of bring those issues into it a little bit more, and the idea of the persecuted person from the time, as we know they actually were. And by the 70s, this was a more sort of open and better understood issue and something that you would want to talk about in this, as opposed to it being a little less present in M.R. James' time.
Yeah. Okay, fascinating. We've got to turn our attention to the beasties themselves, these spider monsters. Where do you fall, Brian, on the creepy or ridiculous side of that particular argument?
I found them creepy, and it was, as I've alluded to before, more how they were used than the actual, you know, sort of puppet props themselves. The first glimpses we see of them are very shadowy, and I wasn't expecting to see an actual monster there, and you suddenly get glimpses of something very strange that I couldn't tell exactly what I was looking at. So I thought especially those first glimpses were very effective.
Yes, I mean, I personally found them incredibly creepy and very well done. As you say, the scene very briefly at first, something scurrying across the shot quickly, this strange and terrible mewing cry that they have, so the sound effect is wonderful. And there's a shot, I'm sort of giving things away, but there's a shot of several of these creatures feasting on a body that is... remarkable. It's a brief shot, which is just as well, because it's quite shocking and disturbing. So yeah, I like them. I think they are very well done as a special effect. I don't agree with Lawrence Gordon Clark's own assessment of them as a slight failure for the show. I think they worked really well. But I'd be interested to know what our listeners feel about them, whether they think they are similar to the slightly odd rubber glove we had last year in the stalls of Barchester, or whether they do represent a terribly terrifying moment from childhood, perhaps.
I have to agree that those screeching cries that come in a little later with these creatures is very effective. And it's sort of chilling when you hear that.
Absolutely, yes. Did you have anything on the negative side for this particular episode, the Ash Tree?
I don't have a lot. On the whole, it was really quite strong. It was a little bit short. I don't know if that's sort of just right for this, or if maybe they could have expanded one or two things. I don't know. But all in all, it's definitely a strong one.
Okay. I wondered, I mean, this is going to make me sound like a terrible prude, but I wondered if they really needed the shot of the young witch topless and tied up and about to be tortured by Sir Matthew. But there you go. It is in there, and we warned you, so that may put you off or turn you on to this show. Who knows?
It is a good point that in order to give us the sort of character development of Sir Matthew being rather horrible and how he treats Mrs. Mothersoul, and these potential sexual attraction overtones to it, was that the best way to do it? I'm not entirely sure.
Okay.
So now we have reviewed all 8 of the Ghost Story for Christmas 1970s productions that ran on the BBC. Would you like to mention any highlights or any favorites from that run?
Well, as regular listeners will probably know, my favorite is the one that's included on the box set but wasn't actually an official Ghost Story for Christmas, the Michael Horden version of A Whistle and I'll Come to You, directed by Jonathan Miller. But out of the official Ghost Story for Christmas, I really, really like the Charles Dickens story, The Signalman. From the M.R. James ones, I think it's A Warning to the Curious, which is simply splendid and possibly two of my favourite episodes from that 70s run. What about yourself? Any particular highlights for you, Brian?
Well, for me, A Warning to the Curious is the strongest one on the whole box set. I really enjoyed that one. I thought it was really very well done and got the essence of the M.R. James story beautifully. That was really a neat one. There were lots of good ones. I think certainly the first 6 were all quite strong. When they started getting into the original ones, it was, I think, not quite as strong, but they had a lot of good stuff in here. I'll also mention The Signalman by Charles Dickens as a highlight, because it was something that was very different and has some really interesting things in it, too. So also a nice one.
Right. Splendid stuff. So when it comes to recommendations, I'm sure our listeners are familiar with us saying that the actual box set from the BFI of the whole series is well worth the money and one of our strongest recommendations from British invaders. But if we were to pick one of these two stories for a Christmas viewing this year, Brian, which would you go for?
It's a tough call. I think I'm going to go with The Ash Tree.
Okay, I'm going to agree with you, mainly because of the marvellous monsters, which I think are really disturbing. I like the Treasure of Abbot Thomas. I think that was very well done and it gave me some chills. But yes, I'm going to go for this year's Christmas seasonal viewing. Sit back in the armchair, turn down the lights, pretend you're back in the 70s and watch The Ash Tree. Let us know what you think. Does it disturb and creep you out like it did certainly me?
Yeah, it's definitely The Treasure of Abbot Thomas is also very good. The classic adaptations that they did in the 70s, the five from M.R. James and the one from Charles Dickens, are all very strong. So there is a lot of good stuff to look at on this box set. Certainly all six of those. Some of the more recent modern ones are also very good. And there are also these readings on there, particularly the readings by Christopher Lee that are done, you know, in period costume with candlelight and everything. Those are also excellent. So there is a lot to recommend on this box set from the British Film Institute.
Absolutely. Splendid stuff.
So, in summary, the A Ghost Story for Christmas series ran for 8 years in the 1970s, which included, for five of those 8 years, they did adaptations of M.R. James' ghost stories. In particular, The Treasure of Abbot Thomas, which dealt with this academic looking at what turned out to be a hidden treasure that he then pursues and, of course, leads to something quite unpleasant for him. And also we were looking at The Ash Tree, which looks at this person who has inherited this manor house and is looking at moving things around at a church, which happens to disturb the grave of a woman who might have been a witch, who was definitely persecuted by his ancestor. And this, of course, also leads to terrible things.
Some wonderful Christmas spooky stuff for you from the BBC.
Absolutely.
So, do come back and join us next time as we kick off 2017 with a show called Moondial, a well-remembered children's show from the BBC, this time from 1988. Some slightly spooky goings on there as well, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. Starting off our 2017 block of shows, we have all of 2017 scheduled now, and we'll certainly be getting into some nice spooky stuff, starting off with Moondial, so that should be a fun one to look at. So until next time, you can find us and all of our episodes at BritishInvaders.com. You can also find us on Facebook. If you search for British Invaders, you will find our group. And we always have some fun conversation and interesting little notes of things going on. So please join the conversation.
Yes, please do. And British Invaders is a proud member of the Voice of Geeks Internet streaming radio network, where British Invaders goes out on Monday and Tuesdays. Drop by vognetwork.com. Tell them Brian and Eamon sent you.
Absolutely. So thank you for listening. This is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, it's Eamon in England saying, burn, you horrible spider beasties, burn!